The State Department issues its annual human rights report today. One focus will be the U.S. effort to keep the internet open and available for people around the world. Activists throughout the Arab world have used Facebook and Twitter to organize protests. So many governments there have been trying to crack down on social media. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports on the State Department's response.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has described the internet as the modern-day town square, and her point person on human rights and democracy, Michael Posner, says he's working on ways to keep that space open.
This is sort of a cat-and-mouse game, and governments are constantly developing new techniques to go after critics, to go after dissenters. We're trying to stay ahead of the curve and trying to basically provide both technology, training, and diplomatic support to allow people to freely express their views.
Posner says the State Department has trained about 5,000 activists on new technology and spent $22 million on ways to help them get around government firewalls in places like China and Iran. The department is finalizing plans to spend another $28 million on new technology to protect websites from denial of service attacks, ensure privacy in text messages, and help out activists like those in Syria who are being rounded up by authorities.
When somebody gets arrested in Syria, there have been hundreds of arrests, the government grabs the phone and looks at your list of contacts. So one of the things we're doing is working with some young technology types to figure out how do you erase the list before they get their hands on it, a kind of a panic button.
Esra Abdel Fattah didn't have that when she was detained in Egypt 3 years ago. Known as the Facebook Girl, she is co-founder of the April 6 movement, one of the groups that organized protests that toppled Hosni Mubarak's regime. Abdel Fattah was here in Washington this week and told NPR that she's still pushing to keep the internet open in her country as one way to ensure that the revolution stays on track.
We need to continue using these tools for campaigning, for propaganda, for reaching people, for discussions with people in very fast way.
She's not only trying to communicate with Egyptians, but says she's often on Facebook and Twitter to exchange views with other activists in the region.
And then now we have connections with people from Yemen and from Bahrain, Syria, and we try to exchange experience between each other.
In an interview in the Office of Human Rights First, the organization that hosted her here, Abdel Fattah said she's been seeking some advice. She's hoping to form a political party in Egypt and possibly run for parliament. The main way the U.S. can help, she says, is to insist on the rule of law, including in the field of communications. Assistant Secretary of State Posner discussed that with her this week.
The fact is the government shut down the internet in 24 hours. So one of the things we talked about is, can you, as a matter of state policy, start to allow more internet providers direct access into the country so it becomes more difficult for a future government to shut things down?
He says he's both optimistic and somewhat anxious about Egypt these days. And more broadly, he's worried that many governments around the world are obsessed with control, spending millions of dollars on technology to crack down on dissent. The assistant secretary says he thinks his job is to make sure activists can get the technology they need to protect themselves and to fight back. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. What if your entire household ran on nothing but a little water and sunlight? No more electric bills, no more heating costs, just clean, green power straight from the sun. Is energy independence just a few sunbeams away? Some may tell you to just look up, not to the sun, but to the trees. Since green life on Earth first began, organisms have harvested sunlight through photosynthesis. While solar cells may be old news, a new invention, an artificial leaf, may use that very same process to bring cheap, earth-friendly energy to a rooftop near you and do it even more efficiently than natural photosynthesis. Researchers say that one of these card-sized devices could power, via a hydrogen fuel cell, an entire household in a developing country for an entire day using inexpensive materials. This work was presented at the meeting of the American Chemical Society. And with me now is Daniel Nocera. He's professor of energy and chemistry at MIT in Cambridge. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Nice to be here.
Tell us what this artificial leaf is that you've invented.
Sure. What happens in first, what does a leaf do when you look up there? You might never have thought what's going on inside all those little guys. But what they do is they take light. And, of course, a leaf, it has trouble getting its hands around a photon. So what it does is it immediately turns it into a current, just like you get a current out of a wall. The difference is the current inside a leaf has no wires. It's a wireless current. And then what the leaf does is it takes that wireless current and then stores the energy in what's called water splitting. That's why you give a tree water. It then takes that water and with this wireless current converted from the sun, it splits water to hydrogen and oxygen. And what we did is the same fundamental functional principles. We take silicon in place of the leaf, and then that can produce the wireless current, and we've created two new compounds, or what are called catalysts, that then split water to hydrogen and oxygen, just like a leaf, and that's why we call it an artificial leaf.
And then theoretically, you could store the hydrogen and use it to run a fuel cell, and then the oxygen for a fuel cell.
Yep, you could run a fuel cell. You can burn hydrogen directly in microturbines. We're looking at things like that. You can burn hydrogen even in generators and engines. And then for people who don't like hydrogen, some people don't because it is a gas and you've got to compress it, then the other thing, you need the hydrogen from water. That's where all the energy is stored. But there's a big push now in the United States in the research community to take hydrogen and combine it with carbon dioxide and make a liquid fuel. So there's a lot of options to burn hydrogen or use hydrogen once you get it from water.
And now how efficient is your leaf compared to a natural leaf?
Yep. My leaf right now, just the one I'm running, is 10 times more efficient than a leaf. But my efficiency isn't being limited by anything I've done. It's being limited by the silicon that catches the sun. So in this paper that I presented last week, the silicon operates at 7%. And then if you look at what I'm doing, the total efficiency is 5%. So I'm basically running at around 80% of the input of the silicon. If I took a 20% silicon solar cell, then 80% of 20%, I should be able to run at 15 or 16%. And then that's even another factor of almost, that's almost 50 times to 100 times better than a leaf.
How close, though, are you to making something practical, a practical leaf?
So I should also mention the leaf was first really demonstrated in 1998 by a scientist named John Turner at National Renewable Energy Lab, and he's still there working away. And he showed that you could do what we did, which is take light and then make this wireless current and then split water to hydrogen and oxygen. But he used basically space-age materials, literally materials that NASA uses when they send things up into space to harvest the sun. And so it was super, super expensive. And so what is the discovery that we have? It's made of all Earth-abundant material. So it's just silicon, cobalt, phosphate, and then a cheap metal alloy to make the hydrogen. And so once you, this is really the name of the game in the energy circles of research. It's to do things cheaply. And the fact that we're using basically commercial stuff and earth abundant materials means we're really closing in on something that could be practical and implemented in a pretty short time scale, we're hoping.
What time scale are you hoping?
Yeah, that's what everybody always says. So once I was on CNN, and scientists always say 10 years, and the first Colin said, how come scientists always say 10 years? So I've gone to 8.1254 years, and being at MIT, when I started, that was a joke. And then, you know, this is always, you got to be careful on the radio and in the news. People said, wow, this is really going to happen because this guy's thought it out really well.
Should give out pi. See if everybody gets 3.14.
But I'm going to tell you, I think right now it's even below 8.1254 years. So we're building prototypes, and there's a lot to still do because you need to make sure this can go for years, right? Not days. It's got to go for years. We haven't had the time to test for years yet. It's been going for days now with no drop in activity. Mm-hmm. So those are all the practical concerns of long term, because if you're a commercial buyer, you're a customer, you only use things that are reliable, and mm-hmm. that can be the death knell of any technology. But we're well beyond the science, and now we're into the engineering and into the reliability game.
Do you have a commercial partner yet for this?
I do. There's lots of commercial partners. So as a typical of MIT, there's a company that was spun off, which is really commercializing the discoveries that are coming out of this project. My lab, you know, I'm an MIT professor, and I educate and train graduate students. So I stay to my day job. The engineering's been being done by a company in Cambridge with lots of well-known people helping me. And then we have some really heavy hitters in the world, industrialists and commercial partners who are also involved with us.
Mm-hmm. And so what needs to be figured out? What needs to, you know, make it commercially successful?
Yeah. Right now, so you in the little ditty that got us going, you mentioned that it's the size of a card. And it is. That's the laboratory demonstration. At the end of the day, you want it to be the size of like two doors in a house. That's how big it would have to be. That I don't think we're going to have any problems with. But here's the thing we now need to do in terms of engineering is we're passing water over silicon, which is the blood and guts of a solar panel. But now I don't need any wires. Most of the cost of a solar panel is the wiring of it and all the other stuff, not the blood and guts, the silicon mm-hmm. cost. So now we've sort of ripped out the inner core of a solar panel. We're just using the silicon. The catalysts that are cheap and earth abundant are on that silicon. But I'm making gases, hydrogen and oxygen, over the surface of the silicon. So what needs to be done now specifically in next steps is to engineer a gas collection system so that those gases can be collected and then used, as you mentioned, later on when the sun goes down to power your house or do what you need to do.
So you have the cell that has bubbling gas, oxygen, hydrogen, and you need to find a way to separate the two and collect them individually.
Yeah, the separation happens. So that's another great thing about this discovery. It's working in just regular water, so you don't have to engineer. A lot of things work in concentrated base or concentrated acid. That means really harsh conditions, and you get big engineering costs. So what I showed at the meeting in movies that people have show or pictures, it's just basically a piece of silicon the size of a card with my catalyst sitting in a glass of water bubbling away. On one side of the card, oxygen is made. On the other side of the poker card, hydrogen is being made. So the gases right up front are separated. So that's not a big problem, but you got to collect them because right now the picture just shows them bubbling off into the atmosphere.
Is this for, you know, when we talk about new alternative energies and cars and vehicles, it's always for some underdeveloped country, a third world country where they would take this, but not good enough for we in this country. Is this something to be sold here or abroad?
So I'm right with you. I'm going into the developing world. There's two reasons for that. One is at least to get your feet on the ground, make something so you can kick the tires and see how it works. It's a lot easier to do there because they don't have as big an energy need as we do here in America or in what I call the developed or legacy world. So it's easier to, as an entry point to impact the developing world because this sort of it's snow with no footprints in it. And it's the snow with no footprints, which is the real bugaboo. You guys and myself, we have a thing called a grid. And so we've invested in an energy infrastructure already, and we're going to be the slowest to accept change because we're tied like a lead weight to what we've had for the last 100 years. Well, when you go into the developing world, people without anything, no grid, especially India, rural China and Africa, a lot of those people have nothing in the ground. There are no wires, so they're much more quick to adapt things.
You just leapfrog 100 years.
Yep. And my feeling has always been, do it there, and then we'll all get jealous and want it. And I will tell you, I probably get 10 to 20 emails a day from people in America saying, please do it at my house. So people in this country, there's an extra value added that I don't think we have figured out as a country of being energy independent. And I think that goes with the spirit of America, have being independent. So I think it could go a lot faster. It doesn't have to just beat the price of coal. Remember, coal's pretty inexpensive, and that's what you're battling with in the United States. Because of this extra value of energy independence, it could go faster, but it's a lot easier to go into the developing world.
All right, we'll keep track, Dr. Nocera.
All right.
Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Okay, Ira. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Daniel Nocera is Henry Dreyfuss Professor of Energy and Professor of Chemistry at MIT in Cambridge. We're going to take a break and come back talking about searching for genetic clues to Alzheimer's disease. A few more clues came out this week. We'll talk about it when we get back. Stay with us.
One deal Google could not pull off was a bid for the online coupon company Groupon. Startups like Groupon and Living Social offer coupons by email, and they're fueling what some call a new tech bubble. Robert Smith from NPR's Planet Money team looks at these newfangled daily deals to see if they'll suffer the same fate as paper coupons.
How much would you pay for this burger?
On the slop burger, we have lettuce, tomato, pickles, onion rings, cheddar, and bacon.
At Corner Burger in Brooklyn, Hilda Hampar charges $9.25. It's fair for New York, but it's not packing her restaurant, so she made a deal with Groupon. They sent out an offer to their thousands of subscribers, $18 worth of burgers and fries for just $9.
Oh, you should see the next day the coupon came out. This place was full. People was waiting outside.
Good news, except for one daunting piece of math. Groupon gets half of the $9. That leaves only $4.50 for Hampar to pay for the food and the overhead. For Corner Burger to make money, they had to squeeze something more out of the coupon customers.
If they come and spend exactly $18, then I don't make any money. But if they come in table of four, they spend $50, $60, $70, I do make a profit.
And even better, the Groupon might convince some of the more cheapskate customers, we should call them, to give Corner Burger a chance. Economists call this price discrimination, the ability to sell the same product to different customers depending on how much they're willing to pay. This was always the principle of haggling.
This bloke won't haggle.
Won't haggle?
Monty Python's Life of Brian got it exactly right.
Come on, haggle. All right, I'll give you 10. That's more like it. 10?
Haggling back in the day had perfect price discrimination. You could size up the rich folk and jack the price, or lower the price for some poor guy walking away. Each time you maximize your profit. In the 1800s, though, with giant department stores opening, it became more efficient to post a single price. But merchants still wanted that haggle. They wanted the cheapskates, so they invented coupons. Richard McKenzie is an economist at UC Irvine.
If somebody is willing to scan the newspapers, clip the coupons, go to the store and redeem the coupon, you can be fairly certain that that individual is a price-sensitive individual.
Oh, paper coupons had a good run. But somewhere in the last couple of decades, they ran out of steam. Once coupons started to show up everywhere, even on the store shelves, they stopped driving business like they used to. They just offered the same deal to everyone. And this is where Groupon comes in. Groupon promised a different kind of coupon, huge discounts to get a lot of attention, a time limit to snatch it up, and a high-tech shine. You can present your Groupon on a cell phone. The company and its revenues grew so quickly that Google reportedly offered $6 billion to buy it. And Groupon turned them down. But it meant the coupon rush was on. This week in New York City, hundreds of daily deal companies came together to look for investors and talk shop. Kirk Barrett is with Double Take Deals.
Using coupons is hip. You know, the one thing Groupon has done for the whole space is made the coupon business sexy. And think about going on a date with your girlfriend. When was the last time you brought a coupon with you? And it's not an embarrassment anymore.
This was, in a sense, a cooler kind of price discrimination, bringing in the young and the wired. But the new coupon craze has a huge downside. It took 100 years for paper coupons to overwhelm consumers. In just 2 years, there are now more than 400 daily deal sites. Businesses report getting calls every day from another Groupon competitor. Patrick Albus with KGB Deals says that already it seems like the huge discounts aren't sustainable.
And you'll see other merchants where it makes sense for them maybe not to offer a 50% discount, but maybe to do something around 25%.
The real question is whether or not the daily deals like Groupon are really bringing in new customers or just breeding a generation of deal hoppers ready to move on to the next discount. Things are already changing in the space too quickly to tell. In fact, Hilda Hampar, the burger lady, just got a call from Google. They're getting into the business soon and want her to offer another burger deal. She says, why not?
Come on, if it brings me 10 people, 10 people is 10 people. If it brings me 1,000 people, 1,000 people is 1,000 people.
If the lines are out the door?
Let them wait.
A packed restaurant, she says, is the best advertising. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD, as well as an online savings account and a money market account. Learn more at allybank.com.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Here's a number that may shock some people. Every week, people around the world spend 3 billion hours playing video games. That's 3 billion with a B, which is not enough for game designer Jane McGonigal. She says we should play even more. She's just put out a book called Reality is Broken: Why Games Make Us Better and How They Can Change the World. NPR's Laura Seidel has this profile.
Jane McGonigal is on a mission, and she'll give a speech anywhere to convert the skeptics.
If we want to solve problems like hunger, poverty, climate change, global conflict, obesity, I believe that we need to aspire to play games online for at least 21 billion hours a week by the end of the next decade. No, I'm serious. I am.
McGonigal is serious. That's what she insisted at last year's TED conference, and that is what she insisted to me.
Oh, come on. You're really trying to tell me that games are good for me? Come on.
What I'm trying to change is this perception that playing a game is just this waste of time. We know that it has a real impact on how we think and how we act.
McGonigal has used games to get people to think differently about the world's oil supply, household chores, and entrepreneurship in the developing world. McGonigal looks a bit like a character in a video game, perhaps an enchanted sorceress. The attractive 34-year-old has a mane of curly blonde hair and cat-like blue eyes. While getting her PhD in performance studies from UC Berkeley, McGonigal took a close look at the behavior of people in games like World of Warcraft. It's the kind of game where trolls battle monsters.
It is cunning trolls like you who will fight to preserve the honor of the Horde.
Even if I failed a quest a dozen times, I'm still improving my abilities with each try that I make. I'm getting stronger, I'm getting smarter. And this is obviously meant to model what would happen in real life if you kept tackling an obstacle.
Of course, that may not mean much when you are solving fake problems in a fake world. But in McGonigal's games, the world might be fake, but the problems are real.
Gas prices jump to over $4 a gallon.
In her game, World Without Oil, the price of oil rises fast.
There is very much police state going on in the streets now.
McGonigal was a consultant on the game. Ken Eklund was the game's designer. Over the course of a month in 2007, Eklund placed people in the middle of a virtual world where they could really see what would happen as the price of oil rose.
Uh-oh, it looks like our transit systems are being overloaded. Uh-oh, it looks like it's very hard to hang on to your bicycle because bicycle theft is rampant.
Players shared blog posts, videos, and audio updates about how they were coping.
I went grocery shopping today, and I couldn't afford to buy food. The only thing I could afford to buy were simple things like Kraft dinner and canned soup.
Chantal Drakecott is a poster child for Jay McGonigal's argument. A game can change the way someone thinks and, most importantly, acts in the real world.
When I watched somebody else's responses, it felt real. And that was kind of the turning point for me, to be able to see all this chaotic action and realize that could be you out in the street one day because you can't get to work, because you can't make money, because you can't feed your family.
When Drakecott went to buy a car in real life, her stepfather was pushing a high-powered engine.
And you think about it. Yeah, we're using so much fuel. How am I going to buy groceries? How am I going to do this? How am I going to do that?
Drakecott went for the fuel-efficient car, which Jay McGonigal says proves her point.
The goal of this game was to get people to make real-life changes to the amount of energy they were consuming, to change the way they cooked, the way they drove, and to do it by challenging them to survive the fictional oil crisis.
But raising awareness of a problem isn't the same thing as solving it. Bruce Woodside also played the game. He recently retired from a career as an animator of online games, and he's seen a lot of designers hype up the power of games. He thinks McGonigal is no exception.
It's very true that people invest a great deal of themselves in virtual worlds. But my principal critique is that it just doesn't translate into any sort of real-world consequences. They may feel better, but the world is still swimming in problems.
Woodside notes that World Without Oil only had about 2,000 players, whereas World of Warcraft, which is all about fun, has 11 million. World Without Oil was produced by the nonprofit ITVS, which is primarily known for its documentaries. ITVS recently had a project about the Zabalin, a group in Egypt who collect and recycle garbage. Kathy Fisher, senior producer of content at ITVS, says the game that goes along with the documentary helps people see how many items in their own lives could be recycled.
And we look at that as a way of working with teachers. So we actually include lesson plans or curricula tied into the game so they could be used in the classroom.
But Fisher says as they try to bring games into more and more projects, they've come to the conclusion that not all topics are ripe for games. For example, the sex trade.
Sometimes animation takes this kind of unreal quality about it, or it makes it much childlike as opposed to this mature topic. So we just kind of felt that it didn't fit.
Games may not be the right way to approach every issue, but Jay McGonigal firmly believes we have to find ways to use them for more than just frivolous play.
99% of boys are playing games, 94% of girls. If we don't tell them that this can be a positive process that can have real-world outcomes and powers and skills and abilities come about as a result, we're throwing away an opportunity for an entire generation.
The number of hours spent playing games has hit 156 billion a year, and it's growing. Jay McGonigal believes that if we can make solving the world's problems that much fun, there's no reason people won't spend just as much time working at it. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. YouTube is best known for viral videos of babies and kittens, but there are thousands of decidedly less cute and more practical videos racking up the views. As NPR's Tamara Keith reports, how-to videos are extremely popular these days, and at least some makers of these videos are actually making money.
Want to know how to crochet a flower, solve a Rubik's Cube, or make a paper airplane? Or maybe you need something more basic, like how to scramble an egg.
In go the eggs.
Even how to use clip-in hair extensions.
All right, you want to take a clip, and you're going to need comb, brush, and your hair extensions.
That's again, Sarah White, a.k.a. Sarah Sweetie 99, a first-grade teacher in Charleston, West Virginia. White says she posted her first video about hair extensions because she couldn't find a good instructional video on YouTube. When the clicks started adding up, she started adding new videos and eventually joined the YouTube Partner Program, where YouTube shares ad revenue with people who post videos regularly.
I thought, well, I won't make that much money from it. You know, I thought I'll make a couple dollars a month, but
I was like, wow, this is really cool. Like, I don't have to get a second job now.
This is a common experience among YouTube's 15,000 or so partners, says the company's Annie Baxter.
A lot of YouTubers describe themselves as accidental entrepreneurs.
YouTube says there are hundreds of people who make more than $100,000 a year on their videos. Baxter says instructional videos are on the rise. Jeff Dorn knows that well. He's the man behind a series of videos on how to tie a tie.
The four in hand knot is one of the simpler knots to tie. Start by grabbing the wide end of the tie in your right hand, the narrow end in your left hand.
In the video, you can't see Dorn's face. Just a close-up of his neck, his white dress shirt, and pale blue tie.
And then straighten the tie with your hands and fold down the collar.
Yeah, that was shot in my kitchen. I think I tacked a white sheet up against what was a red wall.
That incredibly dry video has been viewed 6 million times. He also has videos on the full Windsor, the half Windsor, the Shelby knot, and the bow tie. Dorn says he can pay his property taxes each year with the money he gets from YouTube.
It's nice to get paid for doing absolutely nothing, or doing something once.
Dorn lives in Portland, Oregon, and works in finance, and does actually wear a tie to work every day. But that's not why he decided to make videos about tying ties.
You know, any entrepreneur gets an idea that they want to make whatever, donuts, they want to make whatever they think they're good at, but what you really should do is figure out what the market is and make that.
Dorn made these videos because he knew there was a demand for them. His videos seem to lack personality by design. Sean Plott's videos, on the other hand, are all about personality.
It's Tuesday. It's February 15th. It is the year of 2011. This is Day 9 Daily number 261.
Plott has a daily web show that focuses on the computer game StarCraft II. His mission? Helping a growing community of fellow players get better at the game.
Today is all about mechanics. I want you all to look at your mouse and keyboard right now, and I want you to note what distance is your mouse hand from your keyboard while you're playing. How far is it?
In his videos, Plott goes by his gaming handle, Day 9. He says they really took off when he started talking about himself more.
It wasn't just Day 9, the analytical nerd who just sat down and only talked about how to improve and how to learn. It became this edutainment show. And that helped tremendously.
So much so that when he finishes his master's at USC later this year, he plans to make this web show his full-time job. Tamara Keith, NPR News, Washington.
If you've ever found yourself fruitlessly trying to tap away at a smartphone's touchscreen with your gloves on, you know the problem. It doesn't work. Well, problem solved. Kirk Sigler of member station KUNC reports on gloves that are just as smart as your phone.
So consider this next time you go to update your status to brag about how good the spring skiing is in Colorado. Well, Gene Spencer says skiers' phones are getting smarter, so why aren't there gloves?
They want to be on Facebook. They want to stay on their email all day long. So you just have to make the clothing that allows them to do that.
So Jean and her mom, Jennifer Spencer, invented a glove that makes it easier to operate touchscreens on the ski slopes or in chilly subway terminals. Jennifer is introducing me to the A-Glove here at the Loveland ski area.
If you're looking at this, they're kind of black with a sparkle in them, and that sparkle is the actual silver in the glove, and it's the silver that makes the glove conductive.
To illustrate, they brought an iPad to the mountain, as you do.
Here I am playing the piano.
Even in this wired world, an iPad on the slopes attracts attention.
Right now I'm checking my work email. I don't have any.
The Spencers have handed a pair of A-gloves to curious snowboarder Matthew Coleman, who they spotted clumsily taking off his gloves and trying to make a call.
Wow, I can click really small spaces. I have really good dexterity and accuracy.
But turns out the A-glove is just one example of a growing trend toward manufacturing high-tech gloves, not just for operating personal technology devices either. There are now sophisticated gloves for farming, gardening, baseball, golf. 6,000 feet down the mountain, and I'm at the Park Hill Golf Club in Denver. Now, I'm no golfer, but my friend Joe Fry is.
Okay, so I'm about to hand you a Senso glove. It looks essentially like the glove you just put in your back pocket.
Yeah, except it has for the computer chip on top of your hand, yes.
That computer chip has a screen and reacts to sensors in the fingers of the glove. And when Joe takes a swing, the screen tells him whether any of his fingers are gripping the club too hard. The screen shows a hand with a pinky lit up and blinking, meaning Joe gripped the club too hard with that finger, suggesting his shoulders aren't relaxed enough. But as a seasoned golfer, he's skeptical.
There's 100 pieces of the swing. Your grip is one of those 100.
Joe thinks the Senso glove may be more catered to people like Kerry Zimmerman, who's been eavesdropping on our conversation behind us on the driving range.
And I grip really hard, so I'm probably going to send this thing off the charts or something.
We're getting a lot of beeps.
Something like this is the nuance that could help you, you know, once you reach a certain level, get to the next level.
Well, I probably have more nuances to worry about in my golf game than these two guys combined.
Ow!
A cold, dead shank, right.
All but one finger on the computer chip lights up like it's some sort of golf emergency. Well, even the most high-tech gloves won't help everyone. For NPR News, I'm Kirk Sigler.
This is NPR News.